Jaeger, everyone.
Jaeger. And welcome to the third part of chapter 12. We're joined by Priyank, Chris, and myself. We have no Mike today, but I'm sure he'll join us next week. Are you ready, both of you, for part three?
Yeah, I'm ready. Just before we start, I wanted to say, I think the last episode I talked about being in Lima, Peru. It's very nice here, and I was going to reach out to see, you know, what the SRF locals were doing. And obviously it was a time of recording. It's the 8th of March, and yesterday was our guru's Asamadi. Mm. And tomorrow is going to be our Paranam guru's Masamadi. And so I'd reached out to the Lima email address and got a response to go to a certain address for the Masamadi yesterday. And I went, just about managed to get there with traffic, and I picked up a flower and things like that. So I actually admittedly got there late, but they allowed me in. Yeah, it was two ladies, two sisters. They must have been in their 80s maybe. And then a gentleman, maybe, you know, in his sort of late 50s. And there's four of us there. So small number, but it was lovely that we got to do meditations and chants, and they were doing the chants in Spanish. And so I knew the English version, things like that. But it was a lovely little evening.
Nice.
Got to meet some SRF devotees in Peru. I'm going back tomorrow for the Masamadi for Sri Yukteswar. So shout out to anybody else in Peru. You know, maybe it's the case in London where there are many more people, and they just can come at certain times of the year. But yeah, it was nice to see some spiritual brothers and sisters in Peru.
So is it like a meditation group there?
Yeah. It was in Lady's home and in the sister's home.
That's so special.
They had a very lovely, quite large pictures of the gurus. And they actually had a framed one, very nicely framed one of Sri Yukteswar that they got from the United States when they went over to visit Mother Center. And they were telling me all about it. And I went, you know, went there obviously a little bit late, 7 p.m. last night. And I think I stayed until 11 o'clock. And we were chatting for basically 2 or 3 hours after a short 1 hour meditation. But it was very nice. They had a very nice setup, and it was very sort of high vibrations in there for sure.
This goes to show, doesn't it? You don't need a massive, large group to have a beautiful service
but
or commemoration.
It just felt like home. They actually gave me food and fed me on my way out. They give me a food that I was very used to having when I was growing up in Ireland. It's like a vegetable broth. And it was just like how my mum made it. So it made me feel right at home.
Home away from home. That's so nice, Chris. Thank you for telling us about that. Speaking of homes, in this part of the chapter, I feel like Guruji felt very much at home when he went to Sri Yukteswar's ashram. And so last episode, he'd gone, hadn't he, for the first time in a few months. And we get to the section where this is the following morning. So he's just stayed the night. And it says that Sri Yukteswar chose to give Guruji his Kriya Yoga initiation, which I found really interesting, you know, because it hadn't, you know, Priyank said this as well. It hadn't been that long, for starters, but I'm sure Sri Yukteswar knew, had some foresight. And he goes on to tell us that he'd already received this technique from his dad and his tutor, Swami Kebalananda. So then I was thinking, wow, okay, so what was the difference between both of those you know, initiations and this one? I wonder if there was any difference in how the technique was conveyed, or it would be really interesting to gain some insight. Yeah, Priyank.
That would be interesting. But in terms of how quickly he received this initiation, the general guidance we give to newcomers that straight away ask for kriya is that we say, settle yourself down in the lessons, practice the preliminary techniques of Hongso and the Aum techniques and the other energization and various things like that, and see how your connection to God and gurus, and in particular this lineage, is. And then if you're sure or certain, then you take the plunge, and the because it becomes a commitment. It's not just a whimsical thing that you would do to take kriya initiation, because you're establishing the link and a bit of a duty towards the guru. And so we say do it with caution. So it was quick, but as Lauren said, but they've obviously got a previous connection, so it may be quick by our way of looking at it, but probably not in terms of the grander, well, and we know it's not in terms of the grander whole picture. Chris?
Yeah, I had the same kind of thoughts. And initially I thought, okay, well, the initiation itself is sacred. But I think the difference here is that it's a spiritual baptism in the initiation that Sri Yukteswar has given it. Whereas it sounds like, and this is guesswork, obviously, but sounds like the father and his tutor, Swami Kelbananda, give him the technique only, let's say. Whereas, not to give anything away in the initiation, but it is in itself a spiritual baptism. So you do have that, as Priyank's alluding to there, the connection with the guru being quite a serious event. So it is one not to sort of throw yourself into too lightly. Definitely one to consider. Something actually, I think I may have brought it up before, but it does kind of raise a maybe sensitive topic, one that really isn't talked about much in the meditative circles. But I had a chap who stayed with me for a very short time at the Hika village, and he was an SRF devotee, and I was super pumped to have somebody like him stay with us there. And I thought, wow, this is going to be the start of a, meditative kind of circle, and maybe we can build a community and things like this. But it was before I was initiated, and he said, oh, don't worry about that. I'll teach you the kriya. And immediately I thought, okay, no, this probably isn't going to work. But he was of the opinion, let's say, that anybody could be taught it at any time. It's not a big deal. But I was very much of the opposite opinion. So it is important to maybe highlight that people do see this differently. But I think from what I understand that Master teaches us is very much, no, it is something for a guru to give the disciple, as opposed to getting it off more lay persons. But yeah,
Yeah,
important
fully,
distinction.
fully agree. If you recall in the previous chapter, in the last part of the last part that we did, part nine, where we did the footnote, it was really about the lineage of gurus, the guru and disciple lineage that we kind of have all the way to Shankara and his gurus as well. And part of the reason why I think Guruji put such an emphasis on that footnote and put so much weight and history and facts and names and stories in that is because of the importance of receiving something as important as kriya through authorized lineage or authorized establishment, such as obviously SRF, which Yogananda founded, because it's not, as I say, it's not. Technique is probably just a small fraction of it. The bigger fraction of it is the link, establishing the link to the line of gurus that we know in our six, in our altar, but also to God essentially, which is what that last part of the footnote in the previous chapter talked about. Chris?
yeah, it's a very powerful thing that we've been given, and it has real ramifications in terms of your spiritual ascendance, but the energies that go on and the karmic ties that's involved. So it could be quite perilous, I think, without the right guidance and protection from the guru. But obviously in this instance, to your point, Lauren, you know, we're talking about an avatar in Guruji. You know, we're not talking about somebody who's got, you know, a long way to go. This is a very accomplished soul. So having had some form of teaching from his father, from his tutor, isn't going to be that perilous for him. So I think that's the other distinction I would make there, talking about an avatar.
Perilous is actually quite a scary, but actually quite a good word that you use there, Chris, because I was listening to a podcast about this, about doing the higher techniques of yoga, such as Kriya. And we read from Master's writings in the autobiography, and God talks with Arjuna that, you know, the Kundalini is awakened and the spinal centers are awakened and the energy rises up through the spine. And we do all this previous preparation work, i.e. establishing the link with the gurus firstly, but also to do the preparation work in the preliminary meditation practices to get used to that feeling. So when Kriya comes, then our body and mind is ready to hold, I think in the autobiography says, you know, the 10,000 watt power that the spine has, so we're ready to take it. He's saying that when people take or start practicing higher techniques straight away, I was listening to this podcast, sometimes they go, they can't handle it. They start appearing, they may start appearing to be insane amongst the, you know, community. It's not that they're actually insane, it's just that they can't handle the energy, so they start, you know, acting out in various ways, and they start socially being very strange. But it's because they haven't done this preparation work. And in terms of that preparation work, I found a really good reading for that from Swami Satyananda's book, Chris, if you'd like to read it. It's for Swami Satyananda is Guruji's childhood friend and principal of the Ranchi school, which I keep mentioning, but he's got a fantastic book on Swami Sri Yukteswar, the biography, his biography. So Chris, if you'd like to read that on Sri Yukteswar's requirements now for taking, for a Kriya Bands, essentially.
Is it not so that the invaluable and appropriate unified insights for the age by the great Acharyas of the age were not by themselves able to make us properly aware? It is for this reason that he used to instruct that before initiation into Kriya Yoga, the student should test himself to ascertain whether his physical and mental conditioning was in an optimum state, and he was usually not before the age of 16 or 17, or if there was a lack of physical fitness. Before that, he would advise that one should pay attention to the study and respectful practice of yogic asanas and mudras. The illuminated words of insight from Vivekananda comes to mind. If you want to understand the Gita, first go and play football.
So it would appear that it's really very important to not just find, you know, in this internet age, we can probably find every single technique and detailed description and a video how to do it on the internet, right? But it's important to not go down that line and kind of protect ourselves, because it should come from a qualified, you know, channel. And that's one that means that it has most likelihood and most possibility to work for us. You know, Chris said that someone offered to show him the Kriya technique, and Chris, you know, everything inside him was like, this is, something's wrong with this, right? And rightly so, he listened to his intuition. So you have to be very cautious. And Sri Yukteswar was, and Vivekananda was, and obviously SRF and Guruji are.
Mm. And there's also something about, you know, that spiritual baptism that happens in the moment when you receive it, right? And we have that here in the biography where he says, the master possessed a transforming power. At his touch, a great light broke upon my being, like the glory of countless suns blazing together. There's so much in this. I mean, the transforming power of our guru, both physically, metaphysically, mentally, spiritually, physically. I mean, it's all there, isn't it? And, you know, at that moment where Sri Yukteswara touches him, and the light breaks out, it just reminded me, you know, it's really bringing the literal translation of guru into manifestation, you know, from darkness to light. You know, you just imagine the immense experience that Guruji had in that moment.
You just translated a very important Sanskrit verse, Lauren. Asatoma sadgamaya tamasoma jyotirgamaya, from darkness to light. Just translated it in English without knowing. It's a very powerful Sanskrit chant, that one. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I was wondering, he was obviously very blessed to see the light straight away. And he calls it, you know, countless, the glory of the countless suns blazing together. And we, in the past, in previous, you know, in chapter one of the autobiography of a yogi, when Mukunda was healed from Asiatic cholera by looking at Lahiri Maharshi's picture and, you know, repeating his name as his mum instructed him to do, and he was instantly healed. After that, he had this spiritual experience where he saw the light, and the light said to him, "I am Ishvara." And that's obviously in chapter one. You can reread that. But he's experienced this before, but it sounds like this is countless, tens of thousands of times, probably greater, because this is not just a glimpse now. This is, he's described it, you know, in the next sentence, ineffable bliss overwhelmed his heart to its innermost core. So this is like, it's like graduation, isn't it? Whereas there he was a boy, an elementary school experience of assimilating some knowledge, perhaps, or some small joy. And here this is university level.
And that's why it's so important, isn't it, to get it from your guru or a channel of your guru, you know, otherwise that can't happen for any new initiate, right, to receive that light, whether we see it or not. So yes, that happens, and then Guruji returns home. But he said it was late the following day before he could bring himself to leave the hermitage. I mean, you may not want to answer, but I just wondered, you know, when, after you'd had your initiation, did you get to stay near the place that you were for a while, or did you have to leave? I know I had to leave pretty much straight away because it was nighttime by that time. So we were all sort of trundling out the mother center and the glory of the twinkling night. But yeah. Chris, what's it like for you?
You know, it's funny that you asked, because I couldn't immediately remember. And honestly, I think the best way to describe it was I felt drunk on spirit, you know. And I was, you know, stunned in the silence, and essentially, but I'm pretty sure I went back to Priyank's and stayed there, and Mike was there. Mike and Priyank were helping on the day,
yeah,
the initiation. So speechless, you know, drunk, and, you know, in a bit of a haze, but in the best way possible.
But did you have to leave the place where you got initiated away, or did you get to stay?
Well, we stayed for a little bit to help tidy up and everything, didn't we, Priyank?
Okay.
And then Priyank was, if I recall, Priyank, you were quite keen to leave to get a train. if you remember, but we stayed for quite some time to clear up and help. But I think I was in cloud nine, so it was all just a haze. But I went back to a very nice home with a very nice host. So good hands.
So we had the reason why I was in a rush is because we had a career review the next morning, which I was doing various things for, which I did shouldn't be doing with, you know, half drunken, closed eyes, you know, tired eyes. But this drunken thing that you mentioned, Chris, is a good one. There's a drink that gross spiritualists take. It's called Soma, which essentially it's associated with Shiva and things like that. So essentially, it makes you drunk with spiritual, like, perceptions and feeling and things like that. And it's actually a chemical thing. But the truest form is to generate it yourself. Right. That's an external use of it. But the way to do it is to activate those centers in yourself and then withdraw and get the bliss, or the mana that Guruji calls it in other parts of the autobiography. So you can do it yourself. And I've after my initiation, I was in this kind of drunk and very, I was, yeah, a bit not with it, to be honest.
Dears and his.
And it was such a beautiful experience. And I hadn't had this soma drink. And I thought, this must be exactly what they're talking about, what I'm feeling now. It's such a lovely experience. And then unfortunately, you can't, as with all drinks in this life, you can't stay in that experience because life drags you back. And then I had some commitments that I had to snap out of it, unfortunately. I couldn't hold on to the feeling, as Lauren asked the question, for that long. But I suppose it makes you work harder and harder to experience that when you are meditating at your leisure or practicing Kriya at your leisure.
Okay, so in the chapter then, he leaves the hermitage, and then he fulfills his master's prediction, which is returning home in 30 days. But to his delight, I guess, he didn't receive any of the scornful remarks that he thought his family would say to him about, you know, the soaring bird flying back to the nest. And it made me remark on how, you know, with your guru, you're always protected. And it doesn't mean to say that, you know, troubling things won't happen or we won't face trials or anything like that. But this is such a lovely example of it, of, oh, actually, it's all fine. Because now he's with his guru and all the masters and God in that link.
Yeah, it's a nice moment to reflect on in a way, because it struck me really that it's Guruji's decision to do it, as opposed to, it's not a defeat, you know, it's the nature of the return is quite important, probably, in that he's following his guru's, you know, orders, essentially, you know, to what to do. And of course, they're going to be happy that he's going to be studying and so on. But the nature is a victorious one. It is not a defeatist return. So I think they're going to be rejoicing sharing that moment with him, if anything.
I found a couple of reference to the whole bird paradigm, both in the Mejda and in the autobiography, which virtually say the same thing. And one of them is, the way of the world is thus, a bird accustomed to resting on the perch always returns to that perch. And that's from Mejda, and apparently it's a Bengali proverb, because in chapter 42, Guruji, Param Guruji Sri Yukteswarji, said something similar about our relationship to this attachment to this body and death. He said, just as a long caged bird hesitates to leave its accustomed home when the door is open. But obviously, Guruji, this is not directly relevant, but the use of the bird in the cage and coming back home seems to be a Bengali set of like sayings and anecdotes and that kind of thing. So Guruji, I think, is very glad that he wasn't mocked, wasn't he?
You know, I can kind of relate to this a little bit. My mum would always say the prodigal son returns when she talks to him.
No.
You know, gone around and traveled and lived in London for 8 years. And I remember one time going through a very difficult moment in London, and the world was crashing down around me. And I thought to myself, no, I can go get a job in Belfast, you know, be happy, be close to my parents and, you know, live life there. Maybe I'll be happier. But I remember my aunt giving me some very strong advice just to stay and hold my head high and kind of keep going. And essentially it was push through the difficult moment and persevere. And it did, and it led to much more victorious, you know, moments in the future. And Guruji's had, in a parallel sense, moments like that where he was really struggling, but he pushed through, and he's now in this moment where he can return at his own free will, not because of, you know, the turbulent sort of tides of Maya kind of throwing him back. He's on a much better path because he pushed through more difficult moments.
Yeah, and he had the willingness to obey, right? Mm-hmm. And to want to, which is another lesson for us all as well. And then, you know, when he gets back, he climbs to his little attic room and he bestows affectionate glances as though on a living presence.
I can fully relate to that. Can you two relate to this?
Yes, especially after coming back from initiation, it just changes the way you relate to the altar. You know, you have those moments where it literally is that bestowing affectionate glances as though on a living presence.
For me, that's true, and it's true most days. So as I pretty much have to, my bedroom, as you've seen, it is in the corner of my house, and I have to walk past my meditation room, which was quite a battle to have one established in my old house, because my mum and my sister were living there, and my wife as well. So there wasn't much space. And then we moved here, there was more space, so I could do it. So there was a bit of a struggle to establish it. Now that it's there, I'm really like... it's like exactly as Guruji describes it. It's like a living presence that he's like thankful for, and I am equally thankful for. I mean, and when sometimes I try and retain the sanctity of the place because of its importance. You know, Guruji tells us to establish a corner or a room if you can to for your meditation practices, and I've done that. So I'm like trying to really build up the energy in that place, so like when I go there I can just be in that state straight away. And you know, I think both of you have been in that room. So my sister, my sister-in-law's got two young children, and they're very 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 naughty, and so you can imagine what they would do to my meditation room, which has all sorts of little bits and bobs instruments. Like, it's got a bell that hangs down from the ceiling, and it's got harmonium and drums and all sorts. So you can imagine what they would do. So whenever they come, after the first time they came, like one of the boys scratched, like put a little scratch on Babaji. And I was like, oh gosh. When I told his mum, she was like, oh, look, this is so nice. You'll remember, whenever you see this little tiny scratch now, you'll remember, you know, my beautiful boy. And I was like, yeah, that's just not really the purpose of what we're doing here. And so from then on, I thought, okay, I need to be a bit more protective. So whenever young, very young children come to my house now, I lock the room. And you can imagine this is like causes some like tension between in my household when people come, like my sister's children. So there's like a few weeks ago they came, and I'd locked the room. And my wife's like, no, we need to let, because they're a bit older now, they'll be a bit better behaved. So she unlocked the room, and I'd come back from the center, and I literally came back to the eldest just playing with the bell in the meditation room. Wow. I was like, oh my gosh. So then I just slowly, but I still am quite protective about the room. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing, but I can fully appreciate Guruji's affections to his meditation room. Unfortunately, I haven't experienced some of the things that he talks about here, which Lauren's about to talk about.
But you never know, the children, they might be absorbing something subconsciously, you know, even though he's there ringing the bell furiously. Like, he's surrounded by all these great pictures, right? Hopefully. And the vibration in that room. So you never know, subtly it might be creating some alterations. So in the chapter when he's gone upstairs and he's had to bestow his affectionate glances, he said, this is in quotes, "You have witnessed my meditations and the tears and storms of my sadhana. Now I have reached the harbour of my divine teacher." I find this really relatable because it took me a lot of effort to get to the point where I was ready to have that relationship with Guruji and to be very steady on the path. And it is storms and tears and like trials and just kind of pulling yourself up sometimes or a lot of times. So I really related to that bit. And I think there's a beauty in that when you really actually commit yourself through all of it. And it's interesting because I guess we don't really ponder so much on young Mukunda having storms and tears of his meditation practice, of his sadhana. But he says that there, doesn't he? So there you go.
Yeah, just on what you're saying, Lauren, I think it probably can't be understated just how rare, unfortunately, that journey is, you know, to get to that point. It's not common. So it is a moment to cherish, as Guruji's making very plain for us that even he as an avatar has had to go through this life and for our learning, yeah. But it does take tears, it does take, you know, many storms to pass through, and, you know, the meditative discipline and so on and so forth. So yeah, it's this harbor of divine, you know, reaching the harbor of a divine teacher is, as you say, relatable. And it should be very important because of the rarity in itself is valuable, precious.
He says that tears, you know, witness my tears and storms of his sadhana. Sadhana is spiritual practice and discipline. And I personally need to very much work to get to that same sort of level, because Mukunda, when he was young, up to the age of 18, he was so intense with his pursuit of God and finding his guru. He said things like, "I vouchsafe not to leave the meditation spot till I have, you know, a response." You know, I've personally never done that. I was quite scared to do that, because then maybe after a few hours you give up, and then I can imagine myself giving up after a few hours, and I'm like, I can't believe I made such a proclamation and now after 3 hours giving up. So I'm scared to like commit to something like that. But Mukunda clearly not scared, because he did it on multiple occasions and got his response in various ways, didn't he?
Yeah, Priyanka, I have to say I'm the experience of that, of what you've just spoken of, your fear. Yes, you know, I have vouched. I was like, right, you know, I'm going to do it. I'm going to sit there, and then no, it doesn't. You know, but hey, as long as we keep picking ourselves up, right, every time, that's what counts. I was listening to a talk by Dayamata the other week. And she was saying that the first time she, I think she said the first time she met Guruji, he had said that if you chant Door of My Heart, you can, you know, contact God, be with God. So she said that she resolved to do that. So she went home and she chanted it mentally for, I think she said, over 2 hours. And, you know, she went with tears in her eyes. And then after that, this flood of peace came over her and she knew that God was with her. And it's so inspiring when you hear things like that. And it's like, actually, all the doors are open. We just need to actually do it, which is a lot easier said than done. But yeah, it's like the in the previous chapter, you know, when you know, Mukunda's talking about wanting to find God, and the, I can't remember who said it, it was like, "Well, die then, die trying." It's that kind of
Dayananda.
Yeah,
in the ashram that he was staying in. Yeah,
that's it. Yeah, yeah, that kind of fervor.
Yeah,
there's a reading that I've just found, so maybe we could read it out, and it's on the topic of how to your point on transmuting, say, material desire that tends to be the thing that holds us back from the desire for God, how to transmute this. And it's a quote from Paramahansa Yogananda, and it starts, I'll start it, you guys can continue it. Transmuting material desire for the desire for God, transmuting material desire to the desire for God involves redirecting the flow of prana. We live in exile from ourselves and we are unhappy. But once we know real happiness is inside, is in God inside, we are free to do the work. Then we can practice Kriya with willpower and concentration to direct energy and consciousness to the Christ Consciousness Center. This assumes you are past the point of ambivalence and fear of giving up your toys. Kriya Yoga powerfully works on that energy that is deeply rooted in the lower chakras and difficult to move. So we need to do it with willpower and intensity.
If you have a particular desire, introspect. Get down there and see what it is that you really want and why. The desire for a beautiful house may be a reflection of your desire, of our desire for the beauty of God. The desire for romantic sex is from Maya, making us feel separate and alone. It reflects our desire to unite with God, to realize our inextricable connection to all people and creation. Analyze your material desires. Do you see how they will not give you what you want, but the transmutation of all of those desires to God union will? Transmutation of body consciousness to cosmic consciousness is rebirth, the second coming, the resurrection of Christ consciousness within.
Kriya Yoga takes energy from the senses to its home at the source. Turn the car around and go home. We got here through the descent of the soul with energy going down the spinal cord and out. Home is in and up the cord. Prayer, chanting, and the techniques are not meditation. Meditation starts with stillness. So once you finish the techniques, don't get up. Let the peace absorb into every cell in your body. Don't spill the milk.
Kind of talks to the mechanics, in a sense, behind how do you actually build that desire. You know, Yogananda, like you said, Priyank, has got desire oozing out of him to the point where he's shedding tears, he's demanding God's presence, and how many people really do that? But maybe as an exercise, if we took the things that we maybe desire in life and look at the root causes, like it's said here, we could actually make progress. So it's quite a practical thing. You know, I love these little practical tools to kind of string us along and help us, you know, get past these roadblocks inevitably are in our lives.
Thank you so much for finding that. It was great. great piece of
all Guruji.
Well, yeah, but you've found it. So thank you. So yes, Mukunda's gone home. He's had his moments with the great ones through their pictures, and we get to a point in the chapter where him and his father are sitting down in the evening calm, as Guruji puts it, and his father says, "Son, I am happy for us both." And he says that, you know, you've found your guru in a miraculous fashion, like he once found his. I was quite curious as to if anyone knew how his dad.
Yes, so you'll remember from chapter one, you will remember the story of Mukunda's father's employee, Abhinash Babu, who was talking about the glories of Lahiri Mahashaya and the spiritual life, essentially. And Lahiri Mahashaya, so, and Yogananda's father was saying that, you know, you get ahead, and if you want to get ahead, then do well in your job and essentially put all this religious stuff to one side. And because he didn't want him to grant him leave to go see Lahiri Mahashaya. So then Lahiri Mahashaya then, so Abhinash Babu is chanting Lahiri Mahashaya inside and mentally and affirming his name. And then Lahiri Mahashaya appears in front of both of them and says, "You are too harsh on your employee." Then he gives, not only does he give Abhinash leave, annual leave, Mukunda's father, but he also gives himself leave to go see this great saint that can materialize anywhere and everywhere.
Yeah, that is what you call miraculous, isn't it? Wow. Wow. Yes, and then he says, "The holy hand of Lahiri Mahashaya is guarding our lives." How special is that, really, that his father and son are in the same lineage? So special. And then he says these prayers have been answered because, you know, he hasn't completely lost sight of his son in his son's search for God. And apparently he was also pleased that Mukunda was now going to study formally, and he went to the Scottish Church College in Calcutta. So it was all happening, and Guruji describes them as happy months, and he has a little kind of, I think it's like a little light-hearted comedic kind of nudge that, you know, he says, "My readers have doubtless made the perspicacious surmise that I was little seen in the college classrooms." Yeah, it was kind of surprising to me, though, that not that he wasn't interested in you know, scholarly things, but he says, you know, hang on a moment, he said, he mentions that he's not a scholar, but the way Guruji is, the way he talks, the way he writes is so beyond most things that I've read. So it's quite surprising that Guruji says that, because, you know, he's very learned in different departments, but that comes from God union and God communication, right, rather than being quote-unquote scholarly.
Definitely agree with you there. He, by the, you know, conventional wisdom, he is not a scholar, i.e. he doesn't go into academia, he doesn't write in-depth books about one specific subject. But if you go dive a little bit deeper into his writings, any of his writings, all of that is not true, because as Lauren says, he goes into such depth in various writings about whether it's psychiatry or physiology, nutrition, willpower, you know, all these things that we use in our teachings. He goes into like extreme depth, and like it's very, very scholarly and academic, isn't it, in terms of how he writes it. So that's even leaving aside, you know, all his spiritual scholarly work, i.e. in terms of interpreting scriptures and then God talks with Arjuna and the second coming of Christ and the gospels. So there's so much there. So we definitely would challenge Guruji in his in his statement here in the autobiography, wouldn't we?
Yeah. And even in the Bhagavad Gita, there's so much in there, you know, in the commentary that he writes. It's very scientific. It's very knowledgeable. And there's no end, is there, really? It seems.
History as well. So much in terms of Indian history and, you know, language. And it's just countless, isn't it? He wants us to be so well-rounded in our learning, doesn't he? So he just puts so much in there. But I found it funny that he says that readers, you know, will know that I will surmise that I spent little time in college classrooms. Did you guys, Chris, I can imagine you bunked quite a few classes in university. Would I be correct or not?
Unfortunately, I was known for it, yeah.
There you go. You're such a Mukunda. And I'm sure you would guess that the complete inverse is true for me. I didn't miss a single class at my university, and that was pretty challenging. But Chris, what was the lure of doing something that wasn't going to the classroom?
I think interest, you know, the if you looked at the percentage, it was probably relatively low. It's actually relatively high attendance. But my mental attendance was probably relatively low. I was probably more keen for, you know, that, messing around and fun.
That is exactly the point I was making. Because I, you know, I proudly say that I attended every single class, but how much of that knowledge did I actually assimilate and find useful? Because I remember, for example, I did this one module on astronomy, essentially, astrophysics. And obviously, it's a very dreamy, very romantic science subject, probably the most, you know, romantic one in terms of sciences. And as you can imagine, God and Gurus placed before me the most softly spoken old Scottish gentleman that taught this subject. So soft that even if an insomniac would struggle to keep his eyes awake open in that class. So there was not a single class that I didn't fall asleep. And I'm not known to fall asleep in lectures, even if I haven't slept the whole night. I usually, because I'm so busy taking notes and all that kind of stuff. But he was just something else. He was so, and the subject matter was so good. So what I did was, the previous night, I thought, okay, I'm going to really try hard. Literally forced myself to sleep for 12 hours the previous night. I was like, there's no way I can fall asleep now. I've stayed in bed and slept for the majority of the 12 hours, and then went there, you can imagine, still fell asleep. It's not really about going to the classes, and it's about what you do with that knowledge. I mean, some of my lecturers, like one of my lecturers wasn't a doctor or a professor, he was just a mister, but he was really, really respected because any subject that he did, he really actually did. So he would actually understand it. So like the other professors and lecturers would often be in his class, in his office. Like we'd often go to his office and he'd have like three or four other academics there, and he'd be taking notes and be explaining how to solve their problems. And this is so rare, isn't it? And this is why I think it's not just about going to school and attending all the classes and passing your exams, isn't it? It's about, as Guruji does, you know, in all the fields that he touches, like really understand and assimilate the knowledge and really make it applicable to your life, rather than a degree being a tick box exercise.
I was quite passionate about what I'd studied at university, and I think that, to your point, is basically what managed to get me through. But a good friend of mine at the time, she ended up scoring the highest in the year for the course that we did, or the degree that we did. But she was expressing her displeasure at how I would just show up, do the bare minimum, still score pretty well. So I think you know, if you're really passionate about something, if you try to grasp the ideas, you can do well. And the schools, I would be interested to look at the schools that Guruji, you know, was forming, that, you know, how are they run? Because I imagine not many people are falling asleep in those classes. I imagine that the engagement levels are through the roof, and actually the firm grasp and understanding of the subject matter is extremely high versus what, you know, unfortunately we have in the Western sort of world at the moment with education, that it, like, yeah, I said, is more tick box.
The in India, Ranchi School, which he established, and the Hika School, this first one, they are no longer schools. But what they did was, I think, as the ashrams grew, they moved the schools out to actual, you know, purpose-built properties. So there's about 10, I think, 10 YSS schools around, dotted around India. I haven't been, so one day maybe I'll go to one of those, and Chris, I'll be able to answer that question. But you can imagine, you know, based on Guruji's guidance on you know, classrooms being outdoors and engaging and all that kind of stuff, I'm sure that's all kind of followed. But this whole discussion about tick box and doing all the things that are mundane but need to be done, that also applies not just in school. Like, you know, when you're getting through an exam, you know you'll never ever use this knowledge, but you just got to do it for the sake of finishing that thing. But this applies, good training, isn't it? Because it applies in life as well. There's so many things that you just have to do that really are completely meaningless. You know, from like doing things at work that, you know, no one's ever going to look at, but you've got to do it because it's there, it's in the records, to doing things for me at the center, you know, people, some things that I do no one's ever even going to look at, but but legally we have to do these things, and there's no one ever going, no officers ever going to come in from the government to check, but we just have to do it. And there's so many things like that I just have to do, but I just suppose we've got some good training in doing that from childhood, so well placed. Yeah.
Guruji talks to this a little bit, maybe. He is very jovial in this part, isn't he? So he's saying happy months sped by, that, you know, he jokes about himself that, you know, doubtless precipitous, sorry, what's he saying? My readers have doubtless made the precipitous surmise, sorry, struggling here, that I was little seen in the college classroom. And then he says that he was able to attain passing grades from time to time. He's really making quite light about the whole thing, isn't he? So he's not taking it too seriously, and he's clearly got his priorities in shape given the circumstances. So yeah, maybe in different circumstances it would be a different tone, but he's definitely using quite a jovial one here.
Yeah, it goes with that like balanced attitude, doesn't it, of not taking it too seriously as well, but also knowing that it had to be done for the future. Priyank found a lovely section in Mejda of what Guruji was like and what happened after he met Sri Yukteswar. That's so interesting, so insightful. So we're going to read that now.
Yes, I'll kick us off. After he met his guru, Swami Sri Yukteswar, the length of meditation periods increased up to 30 or 48 hours at a time. One day, during our summer vacation, we all sat down to lunch together. Mejda had just come from one of his prolonged meditations. We hadn't seen him for 2 days. He was withdrawn and silent. As he absent-mindedly ate some of the rice on his plate, it was as though he was oblivious of everyone and everything except the presence of God he felt within. Panchudi, our carer, was silently scrutinizing Mejda's behavior. After a while, I caught a twinkle in Mejda's eye and thought, he is planning some fun. Suddenly, Mejda fell backwards, unconscious. Panchudi shouted, What happened? Are you not well? We could see that he was not breathing. Panchudi felt for his pulse. His heart had stopped. One of the relatives groaned. It is due to this yoga he's practicing. I always knew it wasn't good for his health. Surely his head is reeling. A doctor was called. He had us place Mejda on a bed. Then he examined him carefully. At length, finding no signs of life, he shook his head sadly and left the room. A pall of deep mourning fell over the household. We youngsters cried and called to Mejda, "Get up, get up!" The elders too wept despairingly. They shook Mejda. "Moko, Moko, talk to us."
Jima, our other maid mother, who was Mejda's most ardent protagonist, came running into the room. On hearing what had happened, she took the lifeless form of Mejda in her arms. In tears, she rocked back and forth, crying, "Where are you, Mukun? Oh, dear God, please don't take him away. I swear I will never scold him or say anything harsh to him ever again. He is such a good boy. Please bring him back." We had never seen Jima weeping like this. She was always after Mejda for one reason or another. He spent too much time with his friends. He was wasting his life and would amount to nothing and squander his father's hard-earned money. She never liked his bringing his friends to eat at the house, which he did all the time, and they constantly fought about this. As suddenly as he had fallen unconscious, Mejda sat straight up, shaking with laughter. "So, Jima, you will never scold me again." Because of old age, Jima had to use a cane to get about. Infuriated, she raised it as if to strike Mejda. "Naughty boy, I knew you were only playing. I knew it. Do you think you could fool me? I will show you. One day I too will sit and consciously leave this body." So good, isn't it? But later in the his life, we know that he learned the art of controlling his pulse in one limb, you know, speeding it, stopping it on one side, making it go faster on the other side of the, you know, one arm going one. So it seems that he must have learned these skills at this point in his life, maybe.
It really talks to the relationships that we hold with people and how that forms our interactions with them. Because anybody else that was not the carer of young Mukunda at the time probably would have reverently fell to his feet. You know, if we were there, none of us would be yelling at him, you know, in this way, I'm sure. Right. Obviously, we know more, but, you know, there's much more context to it. But it's just interesting, you know, it's almost the banter, right? You know, one day, two, I'll consciously leave this body. It just shows the closeness of the relationship, but how that actually influences the interaction, because it's such a significant thing to happen, right? This is obviously a very, very enlightened soul just to be able to do this. So it's so mundane, the response, but actually it speaks to the nature of the relationship. I don't think I would be raising my cane to Mukunda in this instance if I was there.
Yeah, really normalizes it, doesn't it, in some kind of strange way. Both her reaction, but also the way Guruji, you know, now he's got all these abilities, right? And he's choosing to still take part in this divine play and to provide sort of some comedy and some fun, but also probably something that was needed as well. I can imagine that perhaps her relationship changed ever so slightly. Maybe she wasn't so, you know, scornful of him and all of that. But yeah, her reaction is so interesting because it's just like, oh, like a child playing a trick, when it's so much more than that. But she's so aware of what it is, right? And I hope she did too learn to consciously leave the body. I really do.
Yeah, so I think that's definitely true, Lauren, because you know, she said that he would she would be criticizing him. You know, she said he said that she was one of his biggest protagonists. Ooh. So he would like say it amount to nothing and he's wasting his time. And one of the things that he's supposedly wasting his time on is this with Sri Yukteswar, right? And now she's saying, one day I too will consciously leave the body. So she's saying the most advanced thing you can do in yoga, and she's saying it. So she's almost acknowledging that okay, this must be something serious. And also her uncle, sorry, not uncle, one of the relatives groaned, said, it's due to this yoga he's practicing. I knew it wasn't good for his health. And so he couldn't be more right and wrong at the same time. It was certainly because of his yoga. But it's not causing a disharmony to his health. It's obviously quite the opposite. So even the relative, no doubt, would have learned a thing or two. And perhaps even the doctor, our learned doctor friend, that sadly left the room.
No, hopefully he was called back and informed. You know, what almost caught me out at the beginning of the reading was the time that Guruji was meditating with Sri Yukteswar. I thought initially maybe there was a typo in, you know, in the reading, but that's not the case, is it? 30 to 48 hours at a time. So that is a substantial amount of time to be meditating for. And I don't think Guruji really mentions this, does he? He doesn't go into that detail. Which is interesting in and of itself, right? Because why preclude that information?
Mejda, I would say, is for advanced devotees.
Yeah.
So people that are new to the teachings, they would read the autobiography and perhaps some lessons, and some may leave at that point, or you know, not finish the lessons, but just, you know, take some of that and, you know, go on with the rest of their lives, perhaps to a different path or whatever. But there's others that stay and they read books like Mejda, and then you go even beyond what's in the autobiography. And you know, this is just scratching the surface, isn't it? It's 30 to 48 hours, because if you'd put that in the autobiography, it's a pretty or in like the early lessons, it'll be pretty daunting for someone new, right? And same with his mysticism. Like, you know, when he was, you know, playing with one of those Aghori yogis with dead bodies and things like that. That's just that if that was in the autobiography, someone would put it down in disgust and walk away, right? But I think it takes a little bit more of what's the word?
Spiritual steel.
And by that point you would have uncovered some things for yourself, so then it wouldn't surprise you as much, or you wouldn't judge it so harshly. You know, you wouldn't say, who could possibly meditate for 30 to 48 hours at one time? You know, that, you know, if you're advanced enough, then you also will be able to do it, and it won't be something that's miraculous. It's something that he needs to do to find God, and that's what he did.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you said it so succinctly, so I won't add too much else, but yeah, it's true. Otherwise, you know, I think if you are definitely new to the path and you're reading autobiography, if you read about a 36 hour meditation, you think, well, I can never do that, and you probably likely give up. You know, you learn as time goes on that actually maybe it is possible. Although I am a long way off from 36 hours.
I think we all are.
The vast majority
of meditators. Yeah. I mean, Guruji, what he does say about it is it's the intensity, the concentration, you know, even if it's 5 minutes, do the 5 minutes with the best of your ability and then build. So it's not about actually just sitting there for time. No. It's more about the quality. That is actually what he says. So he doesn't say 36 hours to your point, because it seems like a very steep mountain to climb, but he gives us that sort of breadcrumb trail to follow.
Mm-hmm.
Once a week, we should do a long meditation, though. It doesn't say how long.
I think you'll find it does.
3 hours. 3 hours? But does he say only 3 hours?
No. Minimum, actually,
don't
I
do,
think.
Don't do more than 3 hours. I don't think that such a line exists.
go watch films and
yeah. But if we don't hear from you, Priyank, in a while, we'll assume that you've really taken that on board and are having a continuous meditation.
I hope that comes true.
Oh, yeah, I do. Yes.
We'll send a doctor around, Greg.
I hope it's the same for both of you.
Thank you. One day. Right. Well, on that hopeful note, we shall finish the episode here. Thank you both so much. It was lots of fun today. And we'll meet again next time for part 4.